855-935-3531. And again, may God bless you and prosper you exceedingly abundantly above all you're able to think or ask. In the name of Christ we pray. Amen.
Thank you. Well, good evening. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls because, we have with us is Ron Brown, and we're going to be talking about what's happening to our economy. Now, I think the average American, their attention fixed on what's happening over in the Middle East, their attention fixed on the SARS epidemic, their attention fixed on the tax cuts that are being suggested in Washington, D.C. Will they go through or won't they get through? Really, our attention can only be fixed on so many issues. And, of course, some of the most important issues we're not even discussing, and that is the future of the American economy, the economy that is really the powerhouse of the entire world. And America is the greatest market in the world, the greatest producer in the world, and the greatest debtor nation in the world. And America is gradually losing its industrial base. In the last 25 or so months, since George Bush has been in the presidency, the exact number of months escapes me now, but since George Bush became president, we have lost over 2 million jobs here in the United States. And, of course, it didn't start with George Bush. It started long before that. As part of NAFTA and GATT, we have been systematically exporting our industry and not only our blue-collar jobs, but now our white-collar jobs, having to do with computers and computer support and software manufacture, moving to India, moving to Bangladesh, moving to China, moving everywhere in the world as part of a long-range plan by the globalists to redistribute the wealth of the middle class of America. Now, you have to understand they're not going to redistribute their wealth. Of course, they're going to maintain their wealth, but the whole idea is a ruling class, a massive police force under the name of the Office of Homeland Security that will monitor everybody in the world. Yes, everybody in the world, in fact. Anybody who'd like to see, got an article just yesterday where they're actually sending people into South America, and we're paying for it, to get dossiers on everybody living in Central and South America, their name, address, their bank account, their physical description, everything about them. They're collecting the details on them just like they're collecting them on you, everything you buy at the store. The legislation now is in place so that the government's going to be able to get the records of every credit company, every credit card company, every grocery card company, so they'll know exactly what you're buying, where you were, certainly whenever you put in a telephone call. They have the date, the time, who you called, how long you talked to them. And, of course, all of this is being collected on dossiers on every person in the United States and soon on every person in the world. And with that, of course, comes this move to gradually actually export our jobs, to gradually lower our living standards. And we don't want to do it too quickly because we don't want to alarm the American people. We don't want them to know what the real agenda is. Well, with us right now is Ron Brown, and he's been watching these things for many, many years. And Ron, how are you tonight?
Just fine.
Well, why don't you give our listeners just a little bit of your take on what's happening as far as our market, as far as our economy, as far as the general financial situation in America?
Well, you know, to fit it into the beautiful picture you just painted, they've been setting a trap for America, I think, for the last 20 years. And, for example, the last 20 years, we had the almost collapse of the market back in the 70s. In 1980, we started a new bull market under Reagan, and our deficits grew wildly during that period. But also during that period, this was key, I believe, is we had exported so many of our jobs that we were now importing most of our consumer goods, and the whole world was desperate to trade with America. So they orchestrated their currencies downward against the U.S. dollar, giving us this euphoric feeling that our currency was stronger than anything in the world. It was, but it was all artificial. So as the whole world scrambled to trade with us, we didn't see any inflation because our dollar was so strong that it covered up the inflation, which is, in other words, things weren't costing more, even though we did have inflation through the increase in the money supply and credit that was expanded wildly. So for 20 years, we've had this euphoric party, so to speak, on borrowed money, where the whole world was financing our deficits. And now, eventually, the dollar reached a point where it just couldn't go up anymore. When the dot-com bubble collapsed, that started the world into a deflationary cycle. Now our bankers are having to print money faster than the market can destroy it, which is causing the dollar to go down. It's now down 25% in the last 12 months.
Yeah, that's in relationship to the euro, isn't it?
Right.
Right.
So, you know, we had a 20-year party where everyone felt there could be no harm done to us because everything was wonderful in America, and now it's time for the hangover. And the hangover is not going to be a small one because we had one heck of a binge, and it doesn't look pretty for what's about to happen to the dollar and the economy.
And, of course, I think that the thing people know that you can't spend more money than you have as an individual or as a nation. Now, we lived very well during the Reagan years when we accumulated every single year of those 8 years of the Reagan administration a $200 billion of additional debt. In other words, we were living off of debt, but things were good. We built up our military, massive spending that was, of course, carried over into the paychecks of individuals. Individuals across the country, but we'd gone from $1 billion of a national debt, when $1 trillion national debt, when Jimmy Carter left office, to $2.6 trillion when Ronald Reagan left office, at $2.6, $2.7 trillion, massive increase in the government debt. And, of course, what people don't understand is we not only spend all the money that we take in, and then we borrow additional, but then, of course, we borrow from ourselves, from the Social Security and the Medicare fund, which is there, of course, down the line to take care of the people who are paying into it today. And what people do not understand is you're going to hear about a $300 billion deficit this year, and that's a lie. The deficit will be closer to half a trillion, if not more than half a trillion dollars for this year, because of all the money they've stolen from the Social Security and Medicare fund. And when you look at the national debt figures, you'll find out that the national debt really is, it's 6.4 trillion, and they're going to have to raise that another half a trillion or more just to get us through the next 6 or 8 or 10 months. We are in the greatest spending spree of all time, massive spending to try to keep the economy from collapsing. But one day, of course, the debt just simply becomes overwhelming, and especially if you have to raise the interest rates, then most of the money coming in will be going to pay the interest on the national debt, and there won't be anything for anything else.
Well, that's right. And, you know, as the dollar was rising and the foreigners were reinvesting their profits from their trade back into the U.S. dollar instruments, as long as the dollar was rising against their currency, they were making money on the currency exchange. In addition, since all this money was coming in, boosting our markets higher and higher and higher, they were making money on the investments as well. So foreigners were very happy with the situation. But now, in the last 12 months, the 25% loss on currency exchange only, and we all see what the markets are doing, they're now losing both ways. So you've got the whole world jockeying for position to phase out of dollars, which is going to make the hangover even greater because for the last 20 years, foreigners have financed our folly.
Well, now, of course, our foreigners are actually pulling some of their money out of it because a lot of it's invested in government bonds today.
That's my point. They're starting to sell their dollar investments and go back to either the euro or to gold or silver. And now you've had the new dinar that's coming over into Malaysia. So the dollar is being abandoned, and we're in the process of losing our status as the world's reserve currency. And that's a pretty lofty status because it allows certain benefits, and that the world is willing to contract all trade in terms of dollars. So the world is storing their reserves in dollars, and that's what's been financing our debt. That's why there has been no discussion of our deficit for the last 15 years.
And so most of the countries in the world are holding dollars as the reserve currency. And of course, but what happens if they stop holding dollars? What happens if they want to get out of our currency into the gold dinar? Or what about the euro? Could the euro become the reserve currency of the world and supplant the dollar?
It's going to take a big percentage of it. And yes, is the dollar, you know, we've had a party for a long time. So as the dollar goes into a panic stage, which it will at some point, and yes, the euro or something will replace it.
Well, now, is the euro backed by gold at all? Is there any gold backing for the euro?
You know, I always kind of laugh at that because a gold backing really doesn't mean much unless you can take that piece of paper and exchange it for a certain amount of gold. But what they're really saying is it's a gold cover clause, or, you know, we have gold behind it, but you can't exchange it. And so the question is, how much gold do they really have to back it, and how much paper are they printing versus that gold? And, you know, it's really not a gold standard unless it's exchangeable.
Well, at one time, of course, the Swiss franc was exchangeable for gold, but even they've got off the gold exchange. Now, what about this gold dinar that they're talking about establishing in the Muslim countries as a sort of a way of retaliating against America?
It would seem like their logical weapon against us. We now know that they have no hope to stand against us militarily. So, you know, they resort to terrorism and unconventional ways of trying to fight against us, and it seems like the dollar card would be the one they would use, and that is to phase out of dollars, start pricing their oil, not in dollars, but in dinars, euros, or whatever.
Well, you know, our most vulnerable position is certainly not in our military strength. I mean, we spend as much for our military as the next 20 nations in the world put together. I mean, Germany will put out, you know, maybe $25 billion a year for their military. Why? Because America has its troops stationed in Europe to protect Germany. What are we protecting Germany from? Why do we still have our troops over there? And we have our troops in Japan. Who are we protecting Japan from? We have our troops in South Korea. We have troops all over the world. Of course, we can't defend America's borders. We can't do that. We can defend the Afghan border against incursions from Pakistan, but we couldn't do the same thing for America. So it seems that our leaders have their own agenda. But, you know, down the line, you know, we're putting out all this money for a massive, massive military, and we have no rivals at all in the world. We are vulnerable from a financial point of view as the world's largest debtor nation. And I think the countries throughout the world that hate us are well aware of that, don't you?
Well, sure. And what better way to dismantle our military might than to bust us economically?
So
if we go into a massive depression, the taxpayer is going to think poorly on spending more and more money for military.
Well, of course, everything that's going on now is to trying to boost the spending of the American consumer. And that's what the tax cut is all about. That's what this whole idea of, you know, trying to have part of Social Security money put into a private account that can be invested in the stock market. Trying to get people to invest in the stock market to keep the market up, trying to keep people spending so that we can keep the economy going, because if the economy ever begins to falter, why, of course, this would be disastrous, not only for America, but for the entire world, because we are the major engine that is keeping all the other countries and their factories going. And if we stop buying, why, those factories throughout the world close.
That's true, and you know, since the bubble burst and the economy has gotten weak, the only thing that's keeping it going, like you say, is consumer spending. I was just reading a few minutes ago that consumer spending is 90% of our economy, and in the last 5 years, according to this article, private credit growth increased $10 trillion, yet the economy only grew by $2 trillion. So you can see that we're having a party on borrowed money, and that can't last forever.
And there isn't enough money out there to pay off all the debt. And what is so interesting, we've been working with a large corporation and actually encouraging people to get their product because I think it's a good product. But over the last weekend, this is a fairly good-sized corporation, they laid off 10% of their labor force just like that, just over this last weekend. I have a friend of mine who's an electrician, used to work in Silicon Valley. He's probably making $40-$50 a day, and certainly when he was working, overtime, making twice that, and he worked, 5, 6, 7 days a week. The last week he worked 4 hours, 400 electricians waiting at the union hall, any one of them anxious to get a job. And suddenly, the economy here in California is really beginning to falter. How about where you live in there?
There was headlines in the paper today about the real estate market, how the influx of houses on the market has slowed down the growth in prices. So, yeah, you can see more and more houses coming on. And, when you talk about the unemployment rise, and every time someone's laid off, that's someone that may not be able to pay their mortgage. And yet we have an real estate boom that supposedly is going to go on forever, and yet people are being laid off by the droves. And so a lot of those loans are not going to be honored. And so once people start defaulting, it's going to get harder and harder to keep that real estate bubble going.
And I agree with you totally. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And we had the privilege of recently on one of our programs of having Robert Prechter as a guest. He writes the Elliott Wave Theory, and he's been incredibly accurate, I think, in recent years. He wrote a book called Surviving the Crash. And, of course, his impression is that we are simply in the intermediate stage of a deflationary recession. In other words, down the line, prices are going to drop, certainly real estate and on many other things here, as people just don't have the money and they're going to have to lower the prices to get people to buy at all. And even though we're bringing in many things from overseas at reduced prices, anything reduced here, they're going to have to drop the price to get people to buy. And people aren't going to buy because they're not going to have any money. What do you think about that? Do you think we're going into at least temporarily into a deflationary recession, at least until, the Fed in its desperation turns on the printing presses and tries to inflate its way out?
When you discuss inflation, I think it's very important to cover the semantics first, because most people are conditioned to think of inflation as higher prices. Inflation is not higher prices. Inflation or higher prices is the result of inflation, which is the increase in the money supply and credit. So if you look at it that way and look at what's going on in the world, when the dot-com bubble burst, you destroyed $6 trillion worth of paper wealth almost overnight. That is massive deflation that Robert Prechter is talking about. And so as our monetary system really is nothing more than a Ponzi scheme in that it's all built on debt, and therefore you have to keep the system growing so you can service the interest on that debt. So when you destroy $6 trillion worth of wealth, then you start the system to collapse it on itself. And that's what Greenspan cannot allow, and that's why the bankers will always resort to try to inflate their way out of it. So the question becomes, can they print the money fast enough to offset what's being destroyed? And Robert Prechter, of course, would argue that they can't, because once they start the printing press rolling fast enough, then interest rates are forced higher, which then destroys the bond market in turn. So you have to do a heck of a lot of printing. So the treadmill keeps going faster and faster and faster as you get into that spiral. Ultimately, I think they will inflate us out of it, and it'll be hyperinflation. So that's where you have to be careful, because then people think they're making money when in reality they aren't.
One of my favorite books is called The Fiat Money Inflation in France. Do you know the book, Ron?
Sure. White?
We carry that by Andrew Dickinson White. It was written 100 years ago by a dean of Yale. And, of course, about something that had happened 100 more years before that, the massive French inflation that followed the French Revolution. If you haven't read Fiat Money in France, you need to get it. It's available through Radio Liberty. It's like deja vu all over again. We'll be right back here in just a moment with our special guest, Ron Brown. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Ron Brown. We're sort of talking about what's going on in the economy today. And, of course, you know, we are living in very uncertain times. Now, most Americans are not aware of really the perilous times we're in. I read just this evening another major factory over in Silicon Valley is picking up, moving to the east. They don't want to have to put up with all the harassment and government regulations and all the things that are going on here in California. I think they're moving to Connecticut. Of course, some of our software companies are actually moving over to India or transferring their software development to India, where you can get people highly trained who can speak excellent English, well-motivated, hard-working, no unions, for perhaps a fifth of what they can hire people here. And so many of our white-collar jobs are moving to India and Bangladesh, even the support. For instance, my son called the other evening, wanted information on his computer, having some problems with it. Got a nice young man on the line. They talked for 20 minutes. This young man knew a lot about computers, a lot more than my son. And my son's really an expert on computers. I trained in the Navy. But this other young man gave a lot of great ideas. And, of course, the conversation, the question arose, well, where do you live? What part of the country are you in? Well, he was in part of Bangladesh. And of course, talking, servicing Americans here on American products. So this is really what we're up against. Are you running into this same sort of thing, Ron? Are some of the people you're talking to aware of the fact we're not exporting not only our blue-collar jobs, but our white-collar jobs?
Oh, I don't think, I've known it for years that that's what they're doing. And in fact, I always go back when I first got into the business, I used to trying to build a clientele, and I used to volunteer to speak to all the city clubs, and that was about the time I'd learned about the Trilateral Commission and what they were up to. So I had sworn to myself I would never speak to any group without mentioning the Trilateral Commission, and I always remember a statement that came from them, and I'll paraphrase it. And remember, this goes back to the 70s, and try to put in your mind what has happened since then, but here's what they said. What we must do is take an end run around national sovereignty, eroding it piece by piece, to raise the standard of living of the undeveloped countries of the world while we lower the standard of living of America so they can more comfortably emerge into a new world order. And boy, if people would just take that little statement, put it above their TV, and every time they watch the news, see if that's not exactly what's fallen into place, step by step, piece by piece.
And, of course, they can't let the American people know that they are transferring their wealth and their children's future to other countries, you know, because then they might rise up and even try to elect some people to Congress to counter the NAFTA and the WTO reforms, legislation that is actually superseding our Constitution, doing an end run around our Constitution, and now supranational bodies tell us what we can and what we cannot do. And of course, the amazing thing is, you hear about free trade. We want free trade. We have tariff rates about 2%, so people can bring things in here, and other countries have tariff rates at 20%. Why? Well, the whole idea is that we are going to transfer America's wealth to other countries. This isn't a level playing field at all. It's a stacked playing field, stacked by our ruling elite to impoverish the American people, redistribute the wealth of the middle class of the United States, and raise the living standards of the average American to that of the Mexican or Chinese peasant. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Ron Brown. Welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, Dr. Stan, our guest this evening is Ron Brown. And Ron, now you've been, of course, following gold and silver and the precious metals for many years. I know that you were involved in selling that. Why don't you tell our listeners what's happening in the gold and silver market? Because, you know, I thought that gold was on the way up here perhaps 6 months ago. It was up 380, 390. Really looked like it was going to break out. Silver was going up. Everything was really looking good for the precious metals, and then suddenly, almost as if somebody had given an order, we see gold slipping back and silver slipping back. I noticed silver is back up again a little bit, but it's almost as if somebody is manipulating the price of the precious metals so we will have nothing to exchange with one another with other than the fiat money, which is controlled by the central banks, which are controlled by a small elite who have a different agenda, a different view of the world than you and I.
Well, the first thing that people must understand is that gold and silver act as a barometer of confidence in the monetary system, or the paper money. And so the central bankers who created this fractional reserve banking scheme, which gives them the ability to create money out of nothing, loan it to the government at interest, and that's a pretty good game if you can get it, isn't it? So they will do everything they can to defend that system. And so they will manipulate and suppress the price of gold. There was a book written a long time ago called The War on Gold, and it just shows all of the different ways that they will fight to discourage investors from abandoning the dollar and going to gold. And so they've been doing that for years. And where we are right now, see, when the bubble burst in year 2000, that ended this 20-year cycle of paper money supremacy. And now it's heading back down, but they're going to defend their turf. But it takes many years to change the psychology. I'm sure you talk every day, and the people out there know people that even though the market has started down and they've lost the massive amounts of their money, they're still hanging on for hope. And they're listening to all the spin that they're about to go into recovery and this thing is going to turn around. So it takes a while to get that psychology where they have no faith in the paper money, and then they seek the refuge of gold and silver, and that's when it'll go through the roof. But that may be a year or two down the road. But we started the new bull market 2.5-3 years ago.
You're talking about the bull market in gold and silver.
That's right. And so gold bottomed out about $250 back in, 2001 or late 2000? I don't remember the exact date. But it kind of reminds me when I first got into business back in 1978. I had done my reading, and I was convinced something was about to happen. Remember the blow-off of inflation under Jimmy Carter and so forth. And the only money I could come up with at the time was to sell my house and take the equity out of the house and put it into silver and a little gold. And I got $25,000 equity. I put $22,000 of it into silver bullion. And then I went and bought me a gold contract to speculate. And that was July, August of 78. By November the 1st, that 2,500 account in the commodity market was over 25,000, and I was just strutting around like a little peacock because I was the smartest guy in the world.
We should warn our listeners out there that the commodity market is a great way to make a small fortune out of a large fortune. Do not get into the commodities.
Yeah, I was about to go to the next step forward. That was about November the 5th when Jimmy Carter, in a desperate attempt to protect the dollar, was dropping and everything was happening wrong. And they came out with his famous 5-point Save the Dollar program. And one of the parts of that program was to start auctioning gold off. Well, gold went from 243 to 192 in 2 days. My $25,000 fortune had went back to almost zero. So it was like welcome to hardball. But the reason I mention that, see, that was the early stages of the bull market. Gold had made a run to 243, and then they overnight beat it back down to 192. Now, that's exactly what we saw late February when you had gold at 390, ready to break through 400, which was a critical level. You had silver at $5 or $4.97, ready to break through that $5 magic level. And then you had the stock market that was floundering. It was down at around 7,500, almost on the verge of breaking through the old October lows of 7,200. When the stock market breaks below 7,000, in my mind, that's when the psychology is going to turn 180 degrees. The people have been hanging on for 3 years, hoping for a turnaround. They're going to lose hope. And that's when they'll start selling all their stock, and they'll look for a refuge. And all you need is 1 or 2% of that money flooding out of paper, seeking the refuge of gold and silver, and gold will go through the roof.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment, too, and we'll with Ron, and we'll Invite your calls at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, I guess this evening, Ron Brown, and we're sort of talking about what's happening as far as the economy is concerned and the precious metals, which sometimes people enjoy learning about it. In fact, Ron, you might be interested to know that program we did, I guess it was Monday morning, on American Freedom Network, why I talked to the owner the following day. And I guess it was this morning, and he said, you know, we got more requests for that program yesterday morning. In other words, they wanted copies of it so they could listen to what was said. So, you know, you may not have gotten much of a response initially, but hopefully those people who actually got the copies will, the program will begin listening and thinking, because people are going to have to do everything from a defensive point of view. You can't depend on the rules that we've followed in the past of being good for the time that lies ahead. And certainly our only real security in the world is our personal relationship with our Lord, our family. But unfortunately, we're going to have to look after our own interests as we begin moving into some truly uncharted waters financially. Because America, all during my lifetime, has been the leading currency in the world. And yet, if you see what's happening, Europe now is talking and taking in 9 new nations. It will be the largest group of people anywhere in the world, with probably somewhere between 350 and 400 million people. They are moving as rapidly as they can to do away with all the socialist programs and rules and regulations they have over there that's disturbing, discouraging economic growth. Schroeder, the premier of Germany, is suddenly saying we're going to have to give up a lot of these wonderful benefits people have. We can't afford them. We're no longer competitive. The unions are screaming. The people are screaming. But Schroeder is hanging to what should be done and saying we're going to have to all bite the bullet if we are going to be able to preserve anything. And Germany has over 10% unemployment at the present time. They tell us we have 6%. They're lying, but it's probably Germany is lying as well. They probably have a lot more than 10% unemployment, and the society cannot survive with, of course, unemployment levels at that level. And, of course, Europe has the potential to become the major economic force in the world. And, of course, that truly is biblical, and as we look and see what's happening, we suddenly realize that 2 months ago, why Europe and America were allies, and everything has changed. We are in a totally different world, and now America has gone off on its own. America has invaded and conquered Iraq. America has its forces more or less permanently stationed over there, and don't believe for 1 minute that we're going to pull our troops out. That's what they told us. You know, after the Second World War, we're going to bring our troops home from Europe, and they're still there almost, 58 years later. And, of course, Bill Clinton promised the American people that our boys will come home from Bosnia by November. He just, as so often happened, wasn't exactly certain which November. Our forces are still in Bosnia and Kosovo and in Europe and in Japan and in Korea. And according to Ron Paul, we have forces in about 140 nations. Now, some of them are very, very small contingents, but we have forces certainly in Afghanistan and in Pakistan and in Saudi Arabia and in Qatar of course, in Azerbaijan and in Georgia and all throughout the Middle East, in Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan. We have forces there. Our special forces units are keeping the dictators in power. And, of course, the average American doesn't understand what this is all about. It's about hegemony. It's about American domination of the world. It's about the Pax Americana that they talk about in the Rebuilding America's Defenses. You can pull it off the Internet at newamericancentury.org, newamericancentury.org. That is the plan that was laid out in the year 2000, in September of 2000, by the Project for the New American Century, this group made up of Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and Jeb Bush and Paul Wolfowitz and James Woolsey and Frank Gaffney and William Bennett. Oh, yes, that's William Bennett, of course, in the Book of Virtues, who they just found lost $8 million gambling in the last couple of years at the gambling tables all throughout. This is a man who wrote the Book of Virtues, and his tapes are being circulated by Christian ministries all across America. Well, I've watched William Bennett for many years, and I'll have to admit, when he, of course, went into this one organization with Gene Kirkpatrick and Jack Kemp, and he and they were paid large sums of money to go throughout the world preaching this neoconservatism that they represent, I realized that there was a great deal of difference between the perception and the reality of what was who these people really were. Because Jean Kirkpatrick is a lifelong socialist, she lifelong Democrat, even though she was appointed to the United Nations by a Republican president. And, of course, when I was a member of the League for Industrial Democracy, so I'd know what they were doing, and that was the American extension of the Fabian Socialist, who was on the board of directors there but Jean Kirkpatrick. And, of course, another member was a woman named Midge Dechter, and she is the only woman member of the Project for the New American Century, she and her husband, Norman Podorodz. And what are these former Marxists doing, working with Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz? And, well, anyway, don't get me off on the Project for the New American Century, but they talk about Pax Americanum. That's what they really want, is a Pax Americanum, just as the Romans had the Pax Romana. So as we look at what's happening, Ron, of course, what can people do to protect themselves? What's happening to silver? We hear, and we've been hearing ever since I can remember, that the world is running out of silver and the price is going to go up, and yet this doesn't ever seem to go up very high.
Well, you know, it's so frustrating to see what I call the greatest opportunity in our lifetime in silver, and yet not one in a thousand can see it. Because, you see, back in the 60s, when under Lyndon Johnson we demonetized silver, we basically dumped, us in the world, around 10 billion ounces of silver that was used as a monetary item. In other words, it was money. They demonetized silver, took it out of the coinage, and dumped all of that silver into the industrial market, saying, you guys can have it all. And so that created a massive, massive glut of silver, 10 billion ounces of silver, just above ground. And so it forced the price down ridiculously low, destroyed the incentive to produce, so the mining industry has been destroyed. Here we are 40 years later, and we're consuming 100 to 150 million ounces more silver than we produce for 13 straight years now. And yet, people can't see the shortage coming. See, that 10 billion ounces is now down to maybe 150, 200 million ounces in the warehouses around the globe. And we're so close to it happening. But it's been out of sight, out of mind for the entire investment life, probably 99% of the people out here listening. So very few people can see the opportunity that is about to hit us overnight.
All right, fine. Well, then you think that there's going to be a silver shortage sometime in the not-too-distant future?
Well, see, part of it's kind of a silly debate if you think about it, because when you're talking about the available silver for industrial demand, that's only half of the equation. Think back to 78, 79, when people started to lose confidence in paper money. Remember the inflation blow-off under Jimmy Carter? And all of a sudden, people realized, you know, they were earning 5% interest on their CD, and interest and inflation was rising at 8 or 10%. And so ultimately they started to change the way they invested, and they started to sell their CDs, cash them in, and invest that money in something tangible, because that's the only thing that gave them a hope of keeping up with the treadmill. And as they did that, then there wasn't enough silver to go around. So if you have a 100 million ounce shortage when there is zero monetary demand for silver, what's going to happen when 0.1% of $100 trillion sloshing around the globe decides it doesn't trust paper money anymore and wants to seek the refuge of silver? I mean, it blows your mind when you think that $5 billion could buy all the silver that could possibly be in the world today. And think about it, $5 billion is not even a drop in the bucket in today's monetary scheme of things.
Well, it's really very interesting. I remember probably about 3 or 4 years ago when Warren Buffett, who is certainly one of the most brilliant men in the world financially, actually bought up a tremendous amount of silver, hundreds of millions of dollars of silver here in the United States and moved them, I believe, over to Great Britain. He stored it someplace else, so it wouldn't be here in the United States, couldn't be seized by our government. But he obviously believes the price of silver is going to go up.
And one of the most brilliant investors of our time, or businessmen, is William Gates, Bill Gates. And he's a big buyer of silver, but he found out, as Buffett found out, I believe, that you don't dare try to buy bullion silver or the powers to be will come down on you with a vengeance. So he's buying his silver through the stock market. He's loading up with a company called Pan American Silver, probably owns 15% of it. But George Soros is also. So there's a lot of brilliant investors that know what's about to happen.
All right, well, let's go to Rob, who's calling in from Liberty Lake in Washington. Hi, Rob. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan.
Right. You got a question or comment?
Yeah, I was wondering, for Ron, what would be the real price of gold and silver if, you know, there wasn't this manipulation going on?
Okay, what would be the real place of gold and silver if it weren't that we were living in a fiat money system where everything's manipulated by the central bank?
Well, there's been a lot of people, one, I can't think of his name right now, but he's studied it for years, and he was saying 2 years ago that gold should be at least $600. I believe that's being very conservative, because once gold starts to rise, or silver starts to rise, then it will draw attention of investors who are tired of losing money in the stock markets. And when you consider that the stock markets of the world, or the paper money system of the world, is probably what, 100 trillion, probably double that, and yet $5 billion would buy all the silver in the world, and you know, it's probably not more than $2 or $3 trillion worth of gold in the world at today's prices. So I think you're going to see gold at least $2,000 to $3,000. Over at least $100 to $200 over the next 2 to 5 years.
Well, the thing is that we have, at one time, Rob, we had a monetary system where money had value. In other words, we had coins, and the coins, the silver coins, had real value. They were made of silver, and we had copper coins for pennies. And, of course, the copper in the coin was worth just about a penny. And the nickel in a nickel was worth 5 cents, and the silver in a quarter and 50 cents and a dollar were certainly worth that. And then, of course, as the price of silver and the copper and nickel went up, suddenly the metal in the coinage was worth more than the coins themselves, because, of course, our leaders were inflating away the value of our currency. And so at that point, why, the silver began to disappear. And, of course, the silver coins begin to disappear. And then, so to get around that, why, then they begin to mint coins with no silver in them, with absolutely no value at all, so that the metal in a penny certainly isn't worth anywhere near a penny, and the metal in a 25 or 50-cent piece is really worth nothing. It was simply another means of bringing us into a totally valueless currency system, so we would have to utilize the artificial money created by the central bank. And of course, whoever controls the money then controls the population. And if you haven't read Professor Quigley's prophetic book, Tragedy and Hope, the History of the World in Our Time, you need to get it. And on page 324, he simply says that the whole idea was the central banks of the world will rule the system, rule the world in a feudalistic manner. They will control their governments by making money available or withholding money from individual countries, and they can simply topple a country anytime they want to. Their purpose, of course, is to rule, create a new feudalistic system, and reward politicians with good-paying jobs once they're out of office. That's how the system really works, but we can't let the American people know that, because, after all, we are a democracy, or we're maybe a democratic republic, or, well, we're some sort of government anyway. We can't let the American people understand there is a ruling elite, and behind that ruling elite, of course, are the powerful spiritual forces that truly rule the world. So the only solution I can see is to get back to a monetary system based upon something of value, and I don't think that's going to happen until the whole system collapses or until the Lord comes.
Well, I took what was left of my 401k and put it into gold bullion, and then I understand, though, that during the Depression, the government confiscated bullion or, fixed the price, and you had to sell it to the government for a certain price. And could that happen again?
Okay, what's the response to that? Because I think that's a real concern, Ron.
Well, I'm convinced that, you know, if you listen to what Greenspan says, he said back in December that we have to bring gold back in the system. So then the question becomes, how are they going to come down with this monetary reform? Because that's what we're talking about, redefining the dollar. Could they call in gold again? I sure wouldn't argue that they couldn't, because they are backed against the wall and the whole world is starting to reject them. You see the whole world starting to come to some type of gold backing, whether it's the euro or the dinar or whatever. So I think in order to compete, we will have to back it with gold, which means it's possible they could call in the gold again. That's why I prefer silver, because silver is more of an industrial commodity. We've been consuming the silver that we produce in the last 50 years, the world literally has consumed almost all of the silver that took 4,000 years to accumulate. So if you look in the warehouses around the globe, you've got 20 times more gold in ounces than you do silver. And yet here is silver 1/70th of the price of gold. So to me, your best bet, if you're trying to preserve, is to put the vast majority of it into silver.
It seemed like people that study these things, you know, would arrive at the same conclusions, that, you know, silver, these things just don't seem to move.
Well, I think that's because of habit. See, for their whole lifetime, silver has done nothing. The only time it did anything was back when Bunker Hunt drove, and silver actually went from $1.29 in the early 70s to $52 an ounce. But everyone kind of poo-pooed that and said, well, that was just one man trying to corner the market. Well, my goodness, if one man could do it anyway, you've got a problem with that commodity. But somehow the world didn't take that serious. And so when they beat silver back down in the $4 and $4 range, everyone said, see, it was just a one-time occasion, it'll never happen again. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. Silver, we're about to run out of silver, and it's the most critical metal to high technology in the world today, much more valuable than platinum or even gold.
If we have like a worldwide depression, I mean, the industrial uses for silver would also go down too, wouldn't they?
Well, yeah, that's an argument they make, but I would give you a counter-argument to that, and that is 80% of all the silver produced out of the mines today does not even come out of a silver mine. It comes out of a copper mine, a lead mine, a zinc mine, or a nickel mine. So if we go into a massive recession that you're talking about, then you're going to be shutting down the nickel mines and the copper mines and the lead mines, right? And in fact, it's already happening. So you're going to be cutting off the production of silver at the very time when people are losing confidence in paper money, because if we go into a deflationary or an inflationary collapse, you're going to see money destroyed. Either people will default on their debts, and so your paper assets become worthless, or they inflate them in oblivion where they become worthless. So people will seek the refuge of gold and silver, and the silver production will be collapsing at the very time monetary demand explodes upward. And that's basically what happened back in the 70s, by the way.
I think it's really all a matter of perception, Rob. It's what people believe is going to happen, will happen, and when everybody believes something's going to happen, it'll go. But nobody can be certain. We can only offer you opinions, and you have to make the final decision, okay?
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks so much for calling. Let's go to Tony for calling from Soquel. But before I do that, Ron, let's get your telephone number out, because I know you've written something on the silver situation, and if people would like to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
My number is 1-800-595-0561.
All right, that's 1-800-595-0561. And what do you send them if they call in?
If they'll call, I'll send them a little package I've put together on silver. I wrote an article a year or so ago called The Unbelievably Bullish Case for Silver, in which I try to explain why it's the best investment in the world, whether you're looking at a monetary collapse or prosperity.
Okay.
Either way, silver has to go higher.
All right, let's go to Tony calling in from Soquel. Hi, Tony. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm pretty good, Dr. Stan.
Good. Do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, I pretty much agree with you, Ron, on silver. I was wondering if you keep up on Ted Butler much.
Oh, yes, every day.
Well, why don't you tell me about Ted Butler, because I don't know who Ted is.
Ted Butler is a man who has studied the silver market He was a commodity broker, and he started to realize something funny was going on in the gold and silver markets. And so he started to study what was happening, and he's the one that has exposed this massive manipulation of the market. And he's been leading the battle to fight the CFTC, the commodity exchange, to stop the manipulation. And, of course, they ignore all of the pleas and all the arguments. But he's done more to expose the real truth about silver than anyone else in the world, probably.
I had sent him an email, and I got a response back from him. But he didn't really clarify my question too much because he didn't really know the answer. So I'm going to throw it at you and see if I can get any better. Now, according to Ted Butler, and I totally agree with him, the reason that we don't see the prices of silver go up is because of silver leasing.
Right.
You know, every time the price goes up, silver gets dumped on the market, gets leased onto the market. But my question for Ted Butler, and in fact, he responded to it that he didn't really quite know, was that how can anyone possibly know how much silver is held in central banks? Because, you know, they're not very likely to tell you. In fact, my statement was they're about as likely to tell you how much silver they hold as they are the names of their stockholders, in which he totally agreed, and said that what his response was that he didn't know, but that one thing that he did know was that the United States government was the largest holder of silver in the world, and that silver is all gone.
Right.
We were at one time. Okay. What's your response to Tony there, Ron?
Well, I think the central banks own very, very little silver. They kind of moved over to gold a long time ago, so gold has been the monetary metal that that all the central banks around the world have stored. Whatever silver they had, I think, was dumped into the markets over the last 10, 15, 20 years in order to hold the price down. You know, for example, our government has dumped well over 130 to 150 million ounces of silver into the market over the last 15, 20 years. And they ran out of that back in, I think, November of 2001. So I don't think the silver to keep this market down is going to come from the central banks anymore.
I got a feeling, Ron, Bombay Tony, that I remember what it was back, you know, in 1979 and 80 when these things ran before. And, of course, at that time, people didn't have any money, so they couldn't get on board. Very, very few people did well, but most people didn't. And I think they're going to wait until the bottom falls out, nobody has any money, and then run it up, and they'll run it up so quickly nobody can get on board. That's sort of what I think, and I don't know when that's going to be. If you figure it out, you let me know, okay?
I have heard... In fact, I kind of surf around on the silver sites every now and then, that the Chinese are actually selling silver.
Ted Butler has done some exposés on that.
I think it came from the Silver Institute, somebody from them. But they said that the Chinese government had begun to sell silver to raise cash. I thought they already had enough. But that they thought that they had enough to keep the price down for maybe 6 to 8 years.
Well, that sounds like something might come from the Silver Institute, to be quite honest. Ted Butler's done some exposés on that, too. And basically, and I don't have a total answer to this, but China bought out a lot of the refinery that went bankrupt in America. And so a lot of the silver is shipped over there in raw form. They refine it and ship it back out, and then the Silver Institute tells you they're dumping silver. Well, they're just running the business of refining silver. The reality is that as China grows economically, then they're going to be, within a few years, the biggest consumer of silver. And I don't think we can count China as our friend, so to depend on them to be dumping the silver to take up the slack for the near foreseeable future is unlikely, in my opinion.
Now, what's Ted Butler's email or website? Anybody can tell me that?
I can.
Okay, what is it?
It's TedButlerResearch.com.
TedButlerResearch.com. Research.com. Somebody called in. Hey, we're going to have to let you go. We got one more caller. Thanks so much, Tony. Let's go to Mike in Santa Cruz. Mike, just about out of time. Question?
Well, hi.
Given silver comes from zinc, lead, and nickel mines, how much silver do you suppose there is in Kosovo?
Good question. In fact, I think you may be leading up to something. That may be why we're over there. Huh?
A good reason why, NATO, why they wanted to send NATO and everybody else in there, and look who owns Kosovo now.
Right. And our troops are coming home in November, though.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad to hear that.
But they don't tell us what's November. Anyway, anything else, Mike?
That's all. Thanks.
Thanks so much. Well, Ron, I want to thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure to have you with us.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be with you, Dr. Ben.
Let's get out that 800 number one more time.
1-800-595-0561.
1-800-595-0561?
Yeah, and I would just encourage everyone to at least check out what we're saying about the silver, because it really does, in my opinion, represent an unbelievable opportunity in a world where there's very few safe investments out there.
Okay, thanks so very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're really dependent upon the people who listen to us, who believe in what we're doing, to help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every day, and then on the weekend on 35 stations, bringing people the news they're not going to get from the controlled media. And of course, if you agree that we're involved in a spiritual battle that's being played out in a political, educational, economic, cultural, ideological battlefield, if you'd like to become part of our team and help us in our effort to reach the average individual who has no idea what's going on, why, please give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And, of course, we are going to offer anybody a free copy of our newsletter. If you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. Let me just suggest that you ask for the March newsletter, which will go into the background of the small clique that took control of our government when George Bush came into power, and it created the war in Afghanistan, created the war in Iraq, and of course they have other plans for the Middle East. And don't believe all these reports about, oh, we're going to get our troops home very, very soon, as soon as stability is reached there. Remember, we left our troops in Europe until they were stable, and our troops are still there 58 years later. So you need to understand what this is all about. The telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. As for the March newsletter, we hope many of you want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And when you do, while you get our four best tapes of the month, you get our monthly newsletter, go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Please tell others about our programs and encourage them to go to our website, where you can hear our programs 5 hours a day and not get anything at all accomplished, where you can pull down our newsletters, and we encourage you to do that and copy them and get them out. And then we ask you, of course, to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders and for our boys overseas, and of course, understanding that of the depleted uranium dust that's over there is going to take the lives of many of them, as it did with the boys who were there during the Gulf War, in certainly in Kuwait and in Iraq. And, of course, if you need more information on the depleted uranium, you need to get my interview with Dr. Rocky. In fact, we'll be having him on, I think, Friday of this week. He was the officer, military officer, who was assigned to figure out how to deal with depleted uranium. And when he said there was no way other than to collect it all and, of course, to destroy it, and that it was dangerous to the health of our people, he was literally forced out of the military. Pray for America. Pray for our leaders. Pray for our men in battle who are still in harm's way over there. And lastly, please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow, when we'll be back with you at the same time, Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you. Well, good evening, Dr. Stan, here at Radio Liberty. Coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And we have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. But please hold your calls, because we have with us on the line right now from the Campaign for California Families, Randy Thomason. Hi, Randy.
Dr. Stan, hello. It was great to see you in person the other day.
Well, it really was. We enjoyed having a dinner with you and your wife. And tell us what's happening as far as the legislation, this legislation that you were so concerned about.
Well, Dr. Stan, as California goes, so goes the nation. And you're absolutely right in your opening comments. People usually get confused about things. But to tell you, marriage is only for a man and a woman. The rights, therefore. And we've got to say what is good and natural. And this is essentially the final 30 days of legislation for the first half of the legislative session. It's really like the last several minutes of the first half of a football game, if that makes any sense there. And so it's pushing for the goal, and who's going to score? And there's actually a huge vote coming up Thursday here in the Golden State, and it's all about, can you believe it, transsexual foster care, cross-dressing, the drag queen lifestyle being foisted upon Christian foster parents across the state. They would have to approve of any sexual behavior among children in their home. And again, these are children. They're not supposed to be supported in sexual behavior. They're not supposed to be having sex in the home and boys dressing up as girls and so forth. More than that, this bill would require foster parents to undergo sensitivity training, and they would really be brainwashed. And what this is going to result in, of course, is a net loss in foster homes in California. Most foster parents are Christians. They're not going to stand for this, and they're going to just quit being foster parents. Dr. Stan, we need some phone calls from your listeners there in the coastal area of California to Rebecca Cohn. She is a key vote on a lot of these issues, as you know. She's running for state senate in a very conservative district. She needs phone calls tomorrow, and she needs to be asked to vote no on this bill. It's called AB 458. Now, Dr. Stan, I've almost got her number memorized, but let me give out those numbers, okay? The numbers, are you still there, Dr. Stan?
I am. I'm listening here, just writing down the telephone numbers.
Okay, good. And that was a good break to let people get their pen and pencil and paper. And please write down Rebecca Cohn's, that's C-O-H-N, her phone number. It's 408-369-8170. 408-369-8170. And you want to tell her to oppose AB 458, the transsexual foster care bill, say, hey, this bill attacks religious freedom and the sanctity of the home of foster parents would be severely invaded. And so ask her to oppose this bill, AB 458. That's very, very important, Dr. Stan.
All right, fine. Now, is there anything else going on? What's happening with the budget up there in Sacramento?
Well, there was a little bit of a deal, a couple mild budget cuts and a lot of borrowing on the future, actually, that alleviated about $3.6 billion in pressure from the, 30-plus billion-dollar budget deficit. More and more, I see the liberal media. They're supposed to be watching. Well, they're watching more, and they see the state piling up debt to deal with deficit. The bankers are very concerned. There's budget anxiety. I see a lot of reporters saying, "Hey, look, how come the legislators aren't doing much?" Well, it's the Democrats who are in charge, Gray Davis and the Democrat majority, and they're the ones who just they'd almost vomit at the thought of making all the budget cuts, because they think that government is the answer to just about everything, and they like the power, so they don't want to cut spending. They'd rather tax you more. Of course,
didn't they have all sorts of giveaways for their friends, and they were bribing a Republican who betrayed the Republican Party a couple of years ago, gave him a full-time job at, what, $114,000, $120,000 a year, and then they found out he had another full-time job working for the state, so that was pretty hard to give him a full-time job working for the Democrat majority there as a consultant when he had another full-time job. What happened to that?
Well, actually, and that was a woman named Sally Havis, and she was fired from her state job, and she is now, the pressure was on the pizza man, as he likes himself to be called, Herb Wesson, the Speaker of the Assembly.
Now, he just calls himself the pizza man because he delivers. Here's the man who brags about how he gets all this money for his cronies and friends.
Yeah, and so but here's the good news is that even the pundits in the liberal media, the newspapers, they are seeing the problem. They're seeing the lack of leadership. They're seeing the lack of care, the twiddling of the thumbs up here, and they're getting upset. I think this is going to drive even more and more of the recall campaign, which our organization is supporting. And it's something that, I mean, there's over 100,000 recall signatures to oust Governor Gray Davis from office.
How many do they need?
They need just about 900,000 total. But the point is, there was a news conference yesterday at the state capitol, a joint news conference between the two arms of the recall, one led by Ted Costa, People's Advocate, the other led by Howard Kalugian down in San Diego, and they got together finally, and they held a news conference at the capitol and said, "We've gone further than any recall election in California history. We have collected over 10% of what we need. Let the counting begin." And the very same day, there was confirmation that Congressman Daryl Issa, Republican from Oceanside area, is going to pony up at least $100,000 to put into this recall effort.
All right. So, well, I'll tell you what, I hope that Mr. Kalugian will, when he writes to people, he'll send him a petition. All he did was send me a net request for funds and no petition. So I thought that was incredibly thoughtless on his part.
Well, I hope they do more, and maybe with a little extra money they can increase the postage just slightly, but get it together there.
No, basically, what are they? They need 900,000 votes?
Yes.
Okay, fine.
Yes.
So what do you can suggest to our listeners if they're interested in participating?
Well, visit our website. We've got the recall petition for you to print and sign and give to your friends to sign. People all over the state are visiting SaveCalifornia.com, and you can too. You can visit there right now or right after this wonderful show has ended, and you can print the petition to remove Governor Gray Davis from office. This has been the most pro-abortion governor in California history. He has signed numerous homosexual and transsexual agenda laws harming the Boy Scouts, parental rights, religious freedom, and the sacred institution of marriage. Dr. Stan, there's so much writing on the line. And you know, when you call Rebecca Cohn, ask her to do something else. Ask her to stop the homosexual marriage bill that reverses the vote of the people. It's called AB 205, and that's a homosexual marriage bill. All the rights under California law, all the rights of marriage, would go to homosexual partners. It's a slap in the face to you, me, and everybody else who voted to protect marriage just 3 years ago. So again, call Rebecca Cohn at 408-369-8170. Urge her to oppose AB 458, the transsexual foster care bill, and ask her to also oppose AB 205, the homosexual marriage bill that reverses your vote.
And Chris, one other thing I wanted to ask you, what happened at that conference you held on the courthouse steps in Salinas last week?
Well, we got a lot of news coverage. We were down there in the Monterey County area, And we got on all the TV news stations, all the major newspapers, and all the mainstream talk radio stations, including your wonderful show. And there's a lot of people who are putting pressure on Rebecca Cohn and Simone Salinas. Those are the two assembly members whose votes will be decisive, we believe, on the issue of will marriage be able to stand between a man and a woman here in California.
All right, fine. Well, thanks very much for being with us, Randy. It's always a pleasure to have you.
Well, Dr. Stan, thank you for your leadership out there on so many issues. Again, our website, savecalifornia.com, where you can sign up for free email updates, get information on these bills, and also print the petition to recall Governor Gray Davis. Get involved. This is no time to move out of California. It's the time to stay and fight.
God bless you. Bye-bye, Randy.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Now we're going to go to Brad Dacus and see if what's going on with Brad. He's on the front lines of the battle from the point of view of the legal aspects, because Christianity and people of moral values are under attack today. The Boy Scouts are under attack. And you have to know, if you really care about people, you're going to tell them if they are involved in homosexuality, it's going to kill them. It's not healthy, and to legalize this action is wrong. They say, well, of course, what does it mean, you know, it's done in the privacy of your own bedroom, and what Rick Santorum had said. If we're going to say that, well, then what's wrong with pedophilia? What's wrong with incest? What's wrong with bigamy? What's wrong with any of these things? And you say, are you equating homosexuality with those things? Absolutely. I mean, it kills people. We have over 500,000 people dead from the AIDS epidemic because the homosexuals organized to block an effective public health policy, and everyone who dies of this disease dies because of the homosexual agenda. And furthermore, of course, the homosexuals are dying. They are the victims of the policies of their leaders. Brad, did you have a statement to make?
Oh, yes, I do. With regards to what you just said?
Well, no, I thought that you might have some bills. I just got wound up there.
Oh.
But you can respond to what I said, or just tell us what's happening in the legal field.
Well, yeah, actually, let me respond, if I may. What Senator Santorum said was a statement of truth. It was a statement of what the Supreme Court had already stated earlier in the famous Bowers decision, where the court made that assessment. And it is an absolute fact that if they uphold the right to privacy in a manner that gives this special protection for that behavior in a state that bans it, then what they're doing is they're giving just the same exact same protection to all those other forms, bestiality, incest, polygamy. There is absolutely no way of separating those out if they come down based on the right to privacy, giving those kind of rights. So it's a very, very important that we, I think, stand behind senators like that that say the truth. And people may not like it. People may say, well, we don't agree with that. But it's true that if they come down in favor of homosexuality, on the right to privacy with regard to what they do in their house, and then they're also at the same time inherently given the same right for adult incest, polygamy, bestiality, everything else, because there's no way of segregating those when you're using the right to privacy.
Amen.
So I think that that's real important to understand, and I've been outspoken about that on the radio, and I just wish more conservatives, actually more people who love the Constitution and justice and truthfulness, would just be honest. And if people want to advocate those things, bestiality and stuff, they can do that, but they need to be straightforward with the American people.
Amen to that. Well, of course, the thing is that none of this is straightforward. Everything is a lie. There are certain rules that have been around for the last 2,000 years, and they were God's rules, God's laws, and he said homosexuality is wrong, and you can't change that no matter how much you try. And, of course, when you do change it, then you see the homosexuals are getting rectal cancer, are getting AIDS, are getting hepatitis, getting all these terrible, terrible diseases because of what they do. And God came up with his laws not to be a killjoy, but, of course, to protect the people he loved, his children. And, you know, if you really care about homosexuals, you're going to tell them what you're doing is wrong. This is why homosexuals die at a very, very young age. I mean, the figures are between 31 and 50, but they certainly don't live on the average in old age because of what they're doing, which is downright unhealthy. And if you believe in public health, you're going to tell them that. Anyway, Brad, what's happening in the legal field?
Well, I was just going to comment just briefly. I was going to comment briefly about two bills that have been brought before the assembly that were going to make things easier for churches to grow and build and expand. But I really don't want to waste your time on that because I found out that they've both been killed. And so those legislation that would basically ensure churches against further discrimination were shot down. So I don't want to create a false hope for the for your audience. But just to say that I look forward to the day that we'll have legislators that will not reel at the concept of protecting churches from discrimination and unethical taxation and preventing them from being able to build like everyone else. So I won't. So I would get out the numbers, but I'm not going to waste. I'm not going to waste the energy and effort of your audience. Just to simply say, we were hoping that we had the opportunity to see them come through. The latest toll on it was that they were not. So we're going to continue what we're doing in the courts, Dr. Stanley, and we're going to continue fighting hard to defend churches. And we just had two more church cases this week, and we're going to move ahead on those full steam.
Okay, why don't you get your telephone number and your website out?
You bet. Telephone number is 888-305-9129. That's 888-305-9129, and our webpage where they keep up with our cases is pacificjustice.org. That's pacificjustice.org.
God bless you. Thanks so very much, Brad.
Thank you, Dr. Stanley. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. That was Brad Dacus out there. And let me just mention the conspiracy conference is going to be held on May 24th and 25th at the Marriott Hotel in Santa Clara. And I'm going to be speaking. Jim Mars is going to be speaking. Some other people pretty far out are going to be speaking. But I think it'll be a fascinating two-day conference. You're going to get a chance to understand much of what's going on. And I will tell you, some of these people that we may disagree with theologically have a great deal of information that the Christians don't have about, of course, the spiritual battle that's going on today. Now, I think they're on the wrong side of the spiritual battle, but they have the information. You need to have this information, too, to understand the true nature of the spiritual battle in which we're engaged. So if you'd like to think about going to the conspiracy conference on Memorial Day weekend, the telephone number is 209-832-0999. That's 209-832-0999, and of course you can go to their website. It's conspiracycon.com. Conspiracycon for conference.com. And if you can't come, I hope you'll be there praying for me, because I'm really going into the lion's den, as it were. But I believe that somebody has to be there to speak for our Lord, and somebody has to be there perhaps to lead some of these people into an understanding of what they're engaged in, because many of these people who see the conspiracy, of course, have gone looking for answers in the wrong places. They've gone to the dark side. Well, next we have with us on the line our good friend Joel Skousen. How are you doing, Joel?
Just fine, Dr. Stan. Good to be with you.
As always, look, of course, Joel is the editor of World Affairs Brief. That's World Affairs Brief, and he comes on with us to bring us up to date on the fascinating things that are going on in the world. What are we going to be covering this evening?
I'd like to take a detailed look at the Bush roadmap, supposedly for peace in Israel. In my opinion, it's the same old flawed Oslo formula. It's going to lead nowhere but war.
They're talking about a war with us involved or a war between the Palestinians and the Israelis?
Actually, broader than that, a war between the various Arab countries and Israel.
All right. Go ahead.
But I think the, obviously the Palestinians have been attempting to defeat Israel, or at least continue to engage it in guerrilla-type warfare and terrorism for many years, and there is virtually no sign that there are any intentions to stop that. But this roadmap that Bush has put together, supposedly with three other not-so-unique parties, Russia, the UN, and the EU, called the Quartet. You know, I don't even know why they brought up that musical name, perhaps to give it some aura of benign intent, but these people are anything but benign relative to Israel. You know, Russia's been the longest-standing supporter of terrorism worldwide, as you know, and has long talked about. They have no business being in any peace plan, especially in Israel, where they, of course, had Russian advisors on the Golan Heights during the 67 war, and have had been advising the Arabs in trying to defeat Israel every time. The EU, of course, is promoting the French agenda, actually. France has long been involved in financing sources of the Labour Party in particular, which was the one primarily responsible for bringing about the Oslo process. Now, for those of you who are listeners who might not understand, the Oslo process started in 1993. It was a secret deal between the U.S. and Israel to all of a sudden get the Israelis to accept the land for peace trade, meaning that we'll give back land of the occupied territories, we'll let the Palestinians have their own authority, their own police forces, their own semi-autonomous area in the Gaza Strip, and they were supposed to you know, get money from Israel as part of the tax settlement. They were supposed to get arms from Israel. And they turned all of those arms and money into building mortars and rocket factories and continuing terrorism, which broke out in the 2000 in the Intifada, the latest Intifada called the Oslo War. Well, now the roadmap, of course, is a hodgepodge of all of the peace initiatives, everything from the Oslo to Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia's proposal. There's nothing new in this other than the timetable, Stan, and this is what's most disturbing about this. This timetable is rapid, what they want this to do. It's amazing that by the end of this month, Israel is supposed to have pulled back from all of its occupied territories in the 1967 war. Now, they haven't been able to accomplish that in the past 15 years, let alone in 1 month. And something's very telling about this time frame. As typical of these land-for-so-called peace processes, the Palestinians are basically required to just verbally assent that they're going to stop attacking Israel, that they're going to recognize Israel's right to exist, that they're going to begin to dismantle terrorist capabilities. You see, all of these things that the Palestinians are expected to do only have a verbal component. Even the things that have physical, verifiable things like dismantling terrorists, they're only required to begin the process. And yet Israel is required to actually withdraw within a month from all of the occupied territories. Now, what that really means is that Israel's got to leave the Golan Heights. That leaves approximately 35 Israeli settlements there completely undefended. They don't have any communications and forward defense against an invasion by Syria from there. Walk off the Golan Heights and Syria can come in and occupy that at any time and bombard the entire Israeli farms down below in the Jordan River Valley.
I think people really don't understand that the Golan Heights are a series of mountains on the east side of the Sea of Galilee. You go up on the top of the Golan Heights and you can look right down on Damascus. It's not that far away. I mean, if Israel pulls off the Golan Heights, then, of course, the whole of the Galilee area is just indefensible.
That's right. And you lose about half of Israel's water rights. Most of the watershed leading to Israel's irrigation plan comes from the Golan Heights. You lose that, too. You lose approximately 50% of the military bases that Israel has. Now Israel withdraws into a territory that's 5 miles wide by approximately 30 miles long. Now think about that. And there, the Gaza Strip, where they will now have semi-autonomy under this to continue to build rockets and other mortars and other things, is only 2 miles from some of the Israeli military bases. I mean, this is just suicide to sit there and let someone have sovereignty to build up weapons against you
And of course, the thing is that no matter what the Jews do, the Palestinians, at least the Palestinian leadership, will never be happy until every Jew has been killed and driven into the sea. Because they are not interested in peace. They're interested in the destruction of Israel. And no matter what they say, they're simply lying. Now, this isn't the average Palestinian, although many of these, of course, have been swept up in this whole attitude of hate. And you understand why the hate when you see the Jews killing your family and friends. But then the Jews, if they don't retaliate, of course, you only encourage the terrorists. So, but who's really funding this whole thing? Why, of course, so much of the money was coming from America, the Hamas and Hezbollah, and then from Saudi Arabia. So we've been funding the various people that are attacking the Jews who we pretend to be defending. What's wrong with this picture?
Well, this is what's interesting. If you look at this roadmap and picture, now this Palestinian Authority has been guilty of terrorism for the past 3 or 4 years, well, actually ever since the Oslo process began. This is documented proof. The United States has the proof. Israel has the proof. The world press has the proof. There's no doubt in anybody's mind that the Palestinian Authority has been paying for and sponsoring terrorism in spite of all of their words that they've said to the contrary. But in the next year, or not the next year, actually by the end of 2003, by the end of May, Israel's supposed to pull back and comply with stage one or phase one of the roadmap. Phase two is supposed to be done by the end of the year, and that Israel must provide enhanced territorial contiguity to the Palestinians. Now, that means that they've got to provide dedicated road corridors that Israel cannot enter into to connect all of the various Palestinian outposts in Gaza, which, of course, is separated from Israel, proper the narrow new Israel that is put forth. This is extremely dangerous because it means now that Israel won't be able to stop the shifting of weapons and materiel and terrorists between the various outposts, and that includes up to eastern Jerusalem. So they'll have from Gaza a dedicated road corridor all the way to East Jerusalem from which they can start attacking other areas of Jerusalem. I asked the question, can you imagine the U.S. allowing Saddam Hussein to negotiate this kind of an institution, to be negotiating from a strength, from a position of strength of terrorism, saying, well, we're going to take Baghdad and we'll keep it for ours and we'll let you occupy the rest of the country, but you've got to be able to let us have roads that go to Basra and to Najaf and to Nazaria, and that you can't walk on those roads, you can't surveil those roads, you have to let any traffic that goes down those roads pass. Can you imagine the United States allowing Saddam Hussein to negotiate something? Well, that's exactly what they're allowing the terrorists of Palestine. Now, there is this sham going on, of course, about the new prime minister, Mahmoud Abbas, who goes by the nom de guerre of Abu Mazen. Abu Mazen claims to, of course, have renounced terrorism. But you've got to remember, this guy has a real history of being a terrorist. He was the PLO's paymaster who doled out the money to the PLO offshoot Black September that carried forth one of 20th century's most infamous terrorist attacks, the killing of the 11 Israeli athletes at the Olympic Games in Munich in 1972. That's the man who's now being promoted by the United States as prime minister.
As a moderate, he's no longer a criminal just because he killed those 11 athletes. Why? Now he is a moderate, and he's a moderate because we say he's a moderate.
Well, and it's the same thing with, the prime minister of Iran, who was in charge of taking the U.S. hostages at the U.S. embassy during the Carter administration, and he's a person that Bush has said, this is a man that we can deal with on a peaceful basis. This is a man who is, committed to the fight against terrorism. I mean, who are we kidding? Only the United States public thinks that these things are true, because obviously they aren't told the background of what's happening here. But there's much more that's happening in this phony cabinet that is being promoted as the new government.
Well, you're going to have to hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Joel Skousen. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and our guest is this evening is Joel Skousen of World Affairs Brief. And before I commit the unforgivable sin of forgetting to allow you to put out your telephone number and website, why don't you get that out right now, Joel?
Well, the World Affairs Brief is a weekly internet news analysis service by subscription, very reasonable price. You can check out all about the World Affairs Brief and all of the archives clear back to 1998 are on the website at www.joelskousen.com. That's one word, J-O-E-L-S-K-O-U-S-E-N, joelskousen.com. If you don't have access to the internet, you can call my office at area code 801-224-4746 and request a sample of the World Affairs Brief, and I'd be happy to send you out the written material that we're speaking tonight about the Bush Roadmap for Peace, or as I feel, a roadmap to future war.
Okay, and that's 801-224-4746, and I will tell our listeners that I read this World Affairs Brief every week when it comes in. I look forward to it. I think Joel is one of the most astute of observers and analysts of contemporary affairs. And so many times you'll hear me simply quoting the things we've learned from Joel. So you pick up the story now. You're just pointing out that the man that we're trying to convince the American people, and the prime minister or president, whatever he is, of Iran, is really simply a part of this whole terrorist movement, as is this new prime minister the Palestine. They keep telling us he's a moderate, so now, of course, we can work together with him and, of course, diminish Arafat's power. But, of course, we've been backing Arafat, you know, for many years, knowing full well that he was a terrorist. And, of course, this whole group that surrounds him are terrorists. So, and, of course, if Israel ever makes these concessions, it will certainly assure that the only solution will ultimately be a massive war over there. That, of course, now that our troops are over there, they'll be drawn into this this fanatic anti-Israel war, where I believe, as Joel does, that most of the Muslim nations over there will attack Israel, and we will be there defending them. And if you think that we're going to get off with 65 casualties in warfare, I think we had a total of 125 casualties, but only 65 in battle the next time around, you're sadly mistaken. Go ahead, Joel.
Well, it's interesting to point out further the hypocrisy of the American position. They are requiring, of course, that the Palestinian Authority must bring all security organizations under the control of the new Interior Minister in Abu Mazen's cabinet, whose name is Mohammed Dahlan. Now, Dahlan is a former protege of Arafat. He's supposed to be anti-Arafat now, if you can believe that. You know, they play like they're all over the map. This is very much a constructed game going on about appearing as if Abu Mazen is in conflict with Arafat. And I'll dissuade your listeners of this in a minute. But, for example, Dahlan, who's promoted as if he's anti-Arafat, is a protege of Arafat. He's the former chief of security over all of Gaza during this entire intifada. As for his track record for curtailing terrorism, if we might be so bold to ask, Dahlan permitted Gaza to become the safe haven for hundreds of fugitive terrorists fleeing Israel police. He's the boyhood friend of Mohammed Deif, top Hamas terrorist. We're to believe that he is supposed to shut down Hamas, run by some of his boyhood friends. On his watch, Gaza became the primary launching ground for all the hundreds of Qassam rockets and mortars fired at Israel. And this is the man that we're supposed to believe is supposed to curtail terrorism and bring all security organizations under his iron grip. Well, if it's an iron grip, it's only going to be to continue to permit it. As we speak, of course, there has been terrorism this week. It has never ended. There was a major terrorist attack on the very day that Abu Mazen and his cabinet was sworn in. And even still, the United States is insisting that Israel provide some welcoming gesture for the new prime minister. They're suggesting that he release hundreds of Palestinian terrorists who are presently in Israeli jails. plus an immediate withdrawal from northern Gaza Strip, you know, where they have military troops in there that are right now and have been hunting for mortar factories and rockets and other weapons of mass destruction that are potentially there. Of course, there's no provision, you know, in this gesture, welcoming gesture for Israel to recapture those prisoners if, in fact, Abu Mazen and his cabinet doesn't end up curtailing terrorism any better than Yasser Arafat did. These Israeli gestures are usually just flaunted, just like Avi Dichter said, who's chief of general security there in Israel. Terrorists have taken advantage of Israeli largesse in the past and to improve their capabilities and carry out attacks. So every gesture that the U.S. wants Israel to take carries with it a tremendous price, and he's absolutely right.
All right, fine. So we are putting pressure on Israel to go along with this plan?
Absolutely. In fact, you know, the collusion between Ariel Sharon and the U.S. has been so complete that Ariel Sharon has been implementing this preparatory features of this roadmap plan months before it was ever announced.
But now, why would Sharon go along with a program that would ultimately lead to the destruction of Israel? Israel cannot survive as a nation 30 miles long and 5 miles wide.
And what's more, this defies all of the red lines. Red lines are terminology in Israel politics that indicates when politicians have made ironclad promises to their constituents, I will not cross this red line. You know what those red lines for Ariel Sharon have been? I will never accept a Palestinian state. And that's what he's trying to shove down the throat of every one of his cabinet ministers who are opposed to this, through the entire Likud party, which is their version of the Republican Party, that are opposed to a Palestinian state. Everybody in Israel knows that you give sovereignty to a Palestinian state and it's going to be a weapons haven preparatory to the next war. That's red lines. He said, I will never allow any dismantling of Israeli settlements. And that's exactly what he's agreeing to in this. Worse yet, of course, he's going to abandon all of these settlements that are legal. In other words, the U.S. says you don't have to dismantle any settlements that were built between March 2001. Well, what good does that do if you withdraw all the military protection from all the hundreds of settlements out around in the occupied territories? You bring all your military back into the small sliver that is Israel proper, and how are they going to defend themselves? Over the past 2 years, a lot of Americans don't realize that the Israeli government has been requiring that these settlements give up their own militia arms. They've been confiscating the weapons that they used to arm all of these settlements with so that they could protect themselves. That's the same thing that they did during several of the other wars, that they disarmed these settlers, and it happened even in the 1949 war. So there is actual betrayal going on the part of the Israeli government of their own people. It's been going on actually for years. I've written about it in the World Affairs Brief. A lot of Israelis refuse to admit this, even as Americans, especially conservatives, refuse to admit that George Bush is selling them down the globalist river, so to speak. But I think it's because these people with globalist intentions have bought off these leaders and brought them into the fold. They're acting on behalf of globalist control people such as Henry Kissinger and group, Brent Scowcroft, Stroke Talbot, George Shultz, Zbigniew Brzezinski, all of these people who are associated with the Council on Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission, and other globalist entities. Every time that Ariel Sharon comes to visit, or Ehud Barak came to visit to discuss things with the president, they would meet with Kissinger beforehand. Benjamin Netanyahu is a protege of the Kissinger group. He's met with him even when he comes to an economic conference to meet with other Jews. So there is an ulterior agenda going on here, which neither the Israelis or the Americans are fully aware of. But I think that best explains why they are betraying Israeli interests.
All right. Well, what is this agenda that is so much more important than the survival of Israel?
Well, here's the agenda. The unique thing about this peace process is that every single Oslo peace process or this roadmap process, everyone requires that Israel cede the occupied territory. You know, Israel's had to win back this territory in four consecutive wars. where the Arabs have been the aggressors, and they have beat them back and taken this territory and then given back the territory in exchange for peace. It happened with Egypt in giving back the Sinai, and Egypt re-attacked. It happened, with various areas of Jerusalem. It has happened with the Negev and the occupied territories now in many regards. And every time they give it back, of course, it leads to another war. I think the real agenda, though, is that the internationalists have always wanted to control Israel as a vassal state. They don't want it to be a sovereign entity. They want Jerusalem to be an international city where the UN controls it, and it's divided into three major sectors, Arab, Israeli, and Christian, under UN control. They've never been able to get there because the Israelis keep actually winning the war. In fact, they would have consolidated their victories to a much higher degree had the U.S. not come in as soon as Israel starts to win and force it into a ceasefire by threatening to cut off arms. This is what the U.S. does every time they want to control a government that's supposedly getting aid and trade from America. It happened to Cuba. They cut off arms to Batista when they wanted him overthrown. They cut off arms to Somoza in Nicaragua when they wanted him overthrown. They cut off arms to Chiang Kai-shek in China when they wanted him overthrown.
But if you remember, of course, in China we brought the communists to power. In Cuba we brought the communists to power. In Nicaragua we brought the communists to power. Why are we always supporting our enemies and punishing our friends? Or is there another agenda here? And of course, you and I both know there is.
Yes, the agenda, of course, is a globalist one. I believe that they need war. You see, they have to always appear, the globalists who run America, have to appear as if they're defending U.S. interest. And that's why I believe that they foment under the table Soviet-backed Marxist revolutionaries in other countries so that they do the dirty work of bringing down countries. And the U.S. can appear as if it is fighting in a token mean, and yet it's actually advancing an agenda. Now, the U.S., of course, does overthrow communist regimes from time to time, and that's usually because they get out of hand or because it's time to move into a globalist leader such as they wanted in Serbia or in Afghanistan or now in Iraq. But clearly they use war as an agenda to get us further into the New World Order, and that's what I think this agenda is in Israel. The peace plan has its main purpose to weaken Israel militarily so that in the next war, which will be a missile-driven war by all of the Arab states that have hundreds and hundreds of Scud and other missiles they intend to launch upon Israel to equal the balance the playing field. They can't beat Israel on even ground in conventional warfare. They need to use weapons of mass destruction. And I think every peace process has its main purpose to weaken Israel so that Israel will have to call upon the UN to save them in this next war. That's what I think they want.
Well, Chris, I mean, you're talking about Libya, which has, Scud missiles. Egypt has them.
Syria.
Syria, Saudi Arabia, Iran.
Iran.
Right. And, of course, we've given them some arrow and a ballistic missile system, but, they could never defend themselves, especially when they have such a small area even today to defend. I mean, they would simply be wiped out with a missile exchange without divine intervention.
Well, they could handle about 20 missiles an hour with the Arabs, with the Arrow system, but the Arabs clearly plan on launching in excess of 200 to 300 missiles an hour. So they're going to overwhelm the Arrow defenses with salvos of missiles, and I think they will have chemical warheads on them. And this will severely dampen Israel's ability to protect itself, especially since they aren't out there on the frontline borders. They will have no troops up there on the border of Lebanon. They'll have nothing in the Golan. Nothing on the border of Egypt. They'll be able to pour in massive amounts of troops. I don't think they're going to win. I think Israel always comes out ahead because of the divine intervention of God. But clearly, we have the U.S. working against Israel. We have the Arabs working against them. We have Russia working against them. And the Israeli government working against itself.
And, of course, but Israel, if faced with annihilation, will resort to nuclear weapons. I have no question that's the case. Do you?
Well, and I'm afraid that that might serve as the trigger for World War III, because if they do have to defend themselves with nuclear weapons, then Russia may use that as an excuse to do their long-prepared preemptive strike against the United States to keep the United States from intervening in this war. So it, you know, either it's going to be the North Korean-Taiwan situation as the trigger, or the Middle East, or both. They could both go off simultaneously if the Russians and Chinese really want to put the U.S. in a box. They certainly don't have the manpower in our very high-tech, paper-thin military to run a two-ocean war. Simply don't, can't do it.
Well, you know, I think we're entering the most difficult and dangerous period in America's history, and the average American is so blithely unaware of this. But see, we won the war. Wasn't the war fun? We saw the whole thing. You know, we saw the real war right on the television in our living rooms, and we only lost 65 men in battle. Isn't that wonderful? And, of course, the trouble is that this is simply the beginning of what I feel will be a period of sorrows for America. And the average American really doesn't want to hear that, oh, we had no right to go into Iraq. We did not have a right to make a preemptive strike. When you ask, where are the weapons of mass destruction, you know, it's people don't like to hear that question asked. Of course, you and I both know that they've been in Syria, and so does the Bush administration. In fact, once in a while, we're even getting little glimpses of that. Judith Miller writing in the New York Times, I think about 2 weeks ago, a couple of articles in the Washington Post, pardon me, the Washington Times, pointing out that missiles, weapons of mass destruction were moved into Syria. But do you think that we're going after Syria next over there, or do you think we're just going to sit back? Certainly Donald Rumsfeld said we don't have any intention of going into Syria.
Well, I believe they're going to go into Syria eventually. Most likely Lebanon, though, first. And Syria, you know, they're protecting Syria right now. They're playing as if Syria is basically coming on board and in compliance, and Syria is extremely dangerous. They may well go into Lebanon first because they have an excuse. Lebanon's an occupied country. If they're requiring Israel to back off from its occupied territories, they're going to require Syria to. So I think that that's the first wave of going in. You know, Syria is one of the major, there are three most dangerous nations to Israel, and that's Egypt, Syria, and Iran right now. Saudi Arabia, depending on which side it's playing, could be dangerous as well. But I'm not so sure that the United States, with a globalist agenda, you know, if they are intending to put Israel in a box where they require or ask for UN assistance to come in and help them win this war, I'm not so sure that that's the reason why the U.S. is playing softball with Syria, because it preserves Syria as a potential weapons of mass destruction threat to Israel. They have to keep intervening, though, in order to create hatred against America. That's why I think they'll continue to intervene next in Lebanon. But it's still up in the air. I know this isn't going to happen probably at least for another 6 months or a year. They want to consolidate the victory in Iraq. They want to have the American people, who are already completely susceptible to going into another country, as long as Iraq turns out to be relatively calm and without a lot of backlash, the American people aren't going to have any resistance at all to this government when it decides to go into Lebanon. But the Arab world will continue to build hatred, and at some point, Russia's going to say, enough is enough, we're not going to let you go in any further, and that's what is going to cause a trigger event for World War III.
Well, you know, it's really so interesting that we keep talking about democracy, democracy, democracy over there. And yet, you know, the majority of the Shiites want want an Islamic State, and they make up 60% of the population. So if we give them one man, one vote, it'll be a one man, one vote, one time, and we'll have an Islamic State, as we really have today, and certainly in Turkey, as we have would have in both Algeria and Egypt if it weren't for our intervention. But we're not about to allow them to have one man, one vote and bring in an Islamic State there. So we're going to talk about democracy, and then we're going to put in our own fixed individuals, even if we have to rig the elections. At least that's my belief. What's your thought?
Well, I'm not so sure that they're going to, you know, they're going to have this interim government for a while, and that interim government is going to have total control of the propaganda organisms of Iraq, as well as unlimited funding in order to propagandize their methods. They're going to bend over backwards, Stan, to make this as successful as they can. You know, these New World Order people, don't ever intend to give people liberty, but they do intend to give them a socialist system, which they're already used to. They want socialism. This complies with what the people want. You know, and as long as you have foreign funds continue to keep a government afloat, you know, socialism can't keep a government afloat on its own without either severe indebtedness or foreign aid at all times. But I think that they're going to try to make this thing go and allow people to be relatively, or you know, think that they're free. They'll continue to bring up the boogeyman aspect of this Islamic State, but I think they're going to have their hands full trying to control it. There hasn't been any Arab state, even when they had democracy under the so-called British mandate. A lot of people don't realize the British tried this whole intervention thing. They won militarily clear back and end of World War One, and tried to cobble together a democracy, and it didn't work in Iraq. And you had this factionalization, and it ended up with a military takeover eventually through Qasim, and who was overthrown then by the CIA and Saddam Hussein. And then we had Saddam Hussein. The same thing will happen eventually again.
Well, I'm sure you're absolutely right, but, you know, we can't let the American people know that. We can't let the American people know that we know we're not going to be able to establish a democracy there, because, after all, we fought the First World War to make the world safe for democracy. And, of course, they keep talking about democracy. We brought democracy to Rhodesia. We insisted on the demise of it. Ian Smith's government, and of course when the people elected Bishop Mizraya, we didn't like him, so we insisted on Mugabe, and we established democracy there, and look how well that's worked out. And of course we had to get rid of Batista in Cuba because we wanted democracy, and we got Fidel Castro.
Of course, there never was an election with Fidel Castro. They simply took power based upon the U.S. intervention here. But what's interesting is most Americans don't understand is that what makes raw democracy always unworkable is the fact that it's always coupled with socialism. Socialism means that whoever controls the majority power, which controls everything in a raw democracy, has their hands in the kitty and can take from the productive class and vote themselves benefits. So once you have this system of combining democracy with socialism, everybody tries to get their hands on the levers of power so that they can vote themselves benefits. And once they get into power, whoever it is, whether it's the minority Sunnis under Saddam Hussein, who got the majority of the benefits? It was the Sunnis. It was the people of the Ba'ath Party. If it's under the Shiites, who's going to control the major funds that come from taxes and oil revenues? It's going to be the Shiites. And if the Kurds controlled it, they would get the greatest largesse. So you see, socialism never works, and raw democracy never works. The only thing that ever works is a constitutional system as ours was originally designed, where no majority or minority can impinge upon the individual rights of others. But the Arabs don't have a concept of individual rights. It is foreign to their whole philosophy. They have a collective mentality, which is very much in line with socialism and majoritarian control.
And of course, the other thing is that this issue of, that wanting to have your clerics in charge of government so that Gala Allah can direct things. And, you know, this, of course, is just madness. You know, they would give up the tyranny of Saddam Hussein for the tyranny of the Islamic clerics, if that should come about. And I don't think we're not going to allow it to come about, of course.
Well, you see, in a good constitutional system, you could have a separate system of control for church people within, if they had their own territoriality, where, you know, they could act as a covenant state, but you can never implant that upon the rest of society. In other words, you can have different levels of law apply under a fundamental rights principle. If they have a fundamental right to run a religious state, if they want to, as long as only people who desire to be part of that religious state are mandated under the clerics. Those that want to be under a secular state have the right to be under a secular government. That's the principle of sovereign states within a federal framework, is that states can have different governmental forms as long as it's based upon initial unanimous consent.
Well, of course, they would have to separate the country into about four groups. One would be the Kurds, one would be the Assyrian Syrians, Christians, and the Chaldean Christians, of course. One would be the Sunnis, and the other would be the Shiites. Those four groups can never live peacefully together.
Well, that's what originally this country was, separate into groups. The Kurds had their own region, the Sunnis had their own region, the Shiites. It was the British who cobbled the thing together as one nation under Iraq. And, of course, I really think there ought to be. They ought to re-separate the things. Separation really is the only way to handle most of these ethnic and tribal things. Obviously, there are some border areas where you have minority and majority people intermixed one another. But over time, I think they'll end up migrating into the areas where they receive the greatest liberty for their own particular ethnic group. So I think I'm in favor of a Kurdish state. I'm in favor of a Sunni state or a Shiite state.
No, I am too, and so but that's, of course, you and I are being logical, and I doubt very much that they will take our advice. Well, what do you think the timetable is as far as the establishment of this impossible situation for Israel, where they're asking them to make increasing concessions to the Palestinian leadership, which is intent upon the destruction of Israel? So my understanding is that George Bush is really pushing to bring this about very, very rapidly.
Yes. See, they've lost a great deal of time. None of these peace plans have ever worked. They've always backfired. And so this timetable is really only going to put pressure on Israel. And the big problem is Ariel Sharon selling this sellout to his own people. If he can sell his own people on this, and it's going to take some agent provocateurs, it's going to take maybe even some war to get him to sell this to his people, because literally he is under real fire from his own people. I don't think Bush has a prayer in the world of getting this thing done this year. I don't think there's a chance that Israel's going to withdraw from all of the territories by the end of May, because the Palestinians haven't even begun to stop terrorism yet. And literally, Ariel Sharon could sell this to people if the Arabs would be smart enough to stop terrorism for even a month, but they're not going to be smart enough to do that. So I think we're going to have more of the same. I don't know how, frankly, Ariel Sharon's going to sell this to his people, but I know they're trying to move ahead even without selling it to them, like they're building this fence along the Green Line right now.
Well, we're just about out of time. What are your parting thoughts for our listeners this evening, Joel?
Well, I think that Israel is going to survive, Dr. Stan, only by the grace of God. When you have the United States working against it, the EU, Russia, and the world, even though our own country is at risk of losing its freedom through our own globalists, Israel alone, for some reason, keeps surviving. And I think that's because of the grace of God. I wish that we had enough promise and prophecy that we might survive, but I'm not sure that we will because of having flaunted the great liberty that the Lord has given us over the years.
Well, I wouldn't disagree with you at all. As Jefferson said, God who gave us life gave us liberty, but can the liberties of a nation be secure when the conviction has been forgotten that liberty is the gift of God?
Great point.
I want to thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure. God bless you. We'll look forward to having you on here in the not-too-distant future.
Thank you, Doctor.
Bye-bye. And I hope you enjoyed Joel Skousen. And I always enjoy him and learn a great deal from him. And, of course, we ask you, of course, to remember to pray for America. To pray for our leaders and to pray for our boys overseas. And please remember to pray for Radio Liberty for our provision and protection. So until tomorrow, the same time, may the Lord be with you.
Feeding him information.
Does he support himself?
What's Gaza? Does he support himself through the World Affairs Brief?
Yeah. Well, I suspect he probably accumulated something for the years. Maybe has something else to provide with information. Maybe he's followed his brother's advice. His brother's Mark Scouse. He's a well-known as a national financial advisor. But, you know, the thing is that he says a lot of things that the Christian leaders won't say. Rather, they don't have. What's happening in America? I mean, Jerry Falwell wouldn't even say that, if God allowed the attack on America, something like that. We're not following his directives. He apologized. He said that, then he apologized for it. He never should have apologized. So I wish didn't want that to be said. And Jerry Falwell, that's what he was convictions. What's that?
Tonight was nice and uneventful for a change.
I saw this book.